Welcome to Running Off the Rails. My name is Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Rasko.
And today, we're talking about mysteries in Dungeons & Dragons. Dungeons & Dragons presents players with a very unique and spectacular detective fantasy opportunity. When we think of fantasy detectives, we don't think of beat cops. We think of iconic heroes like Sherlock Holmes, The Mentalist, and perhaps the best example, Batman. These characters are called upon when all others have failed to solve the mysteries that no one else can.
This is, in a way, exactly like Dungeons & Dragons. Your characters are adventurers. The most common thing that happens in D&D is that you're given a quest. You are called upon to do something that others cannot. So I think it's interesting that there's this common wisdom that you shouldn't run mysteries in Dungeons & Dragons. You can look at an example like the Pink Panther. The mystery of the Pink Panther is trivialized by the Locate Object spell. You just ask your deity, where is the Pink Panther diamond, or scry on it, and boom, mystery solved.
Or the classic locked room mystery, like Clue or the Hateful Eight, where the culprit has to be someone that's in the room with you, and you can read their thoughts with something like the Detect Thought spell, or at least interrogate them knowing that you'll get truthful answers, using a spell like Zone of Truth.
Or any classic murder mystery, where you can simply go to the body and ask them who killed them with the Speak with Dead spell. Pretty quickly, it becomes obvious that you can't always drop your favorite mystery straight into your setting and expect it to work. But clearly people want to experience the fantasy of the mystery genre, and they don't just want to play in a mystery board game or video game like Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, which is a great game, by the way. They want to solve fantastical D&D mysteries with their fantastical and iconic D&D player characters.
Clearly the scope of this conversation is expansive. So we're going to break this conversation up into multiple episodes. Today, we're going to be looking at this challenge at a high level, talking about abstract things like the mystery genre and how that genre is and is not compatible with the D&D rule set. Then next episode, we'll start putting these ideas into action.
So we want to specifically talk about what a mystery is, what are different types of mysteries, and what are the core elements that make a compelling mystery. We want to be intentional when we sit down to design an adventure or a session of D&D. So just listing out what these core elements are, I think, can really help us to plan a great mystery.
The word mystery can sometimes be a little bit overloaded. In this episode, we want to distinguish between two different types of mystery. Capital M mystery, which are genre-defining stories, and lowercase m mysteries, open questions that appear in our favorite books and movies that aren't solved as a direct result of the protagonist trying to be a detective and putting the clues together.
One example of a lowercase m mystery in Dungeons & Dragons might be the intro to Storm King's Thunder, where a group of frost giants attack the Sword Coast, and you don't know why they're there, and you quickly discover when you travel to the giants' ancestral land what the problem was. You just had to go ask them to find out.
This is pretty typical of most Dungeons & Dragons mysteries. There's this open question that is asked, and simply by going to the next place in the adventure, the answer to that question reveals itself to you. Another example of this in popular culture is, who is Luke's father? In the beginning of episode 4, we find out that Obi-Wan was friends with Luke's father and they fought in the war together. And then at the end of episode 5, we get this huge reveal that Darth Vader is Luke's father, answering that mystery, but the audience is not actively doing the work to piece different clues together to figure out that Darth Vader is Luke's father before he reveals that information to Luke. And George Lucas isn't trying to lay the clues in his movie so that someone could figure it out ahead of time. We want that reveal to be as surprising and impactful as it is. So withholding of clues in that situation is actually something that the author does on purpose, because this is a lowercase m mystery.
I think this is a great example, Ray, because who was Luke's father is a big mystery, but I don't think anybody in the world would say that the Star Wars original trilogy is a mystery saga or is a mystery movie.
Right. So then the question becomes, when we're talking about a capital M mystery story, what needs to be there for it to fit in with the rest of the core pieces of that genre? Capital M mystery stories are defined by a specific process that appears in mystery books, mystery board games, mystery video games. The audience is presented with a huge body of information. And the audience needs to decide which pieces of information are important. In this case, these are clues. And which pieces of information are either not important at all or superfluous, and which pieces of information are actually misleading, aka red herrings. And then the audience needs to be able to figure out the mystery before it is explicitly revealed to them by the medium that they are interacting with. In a book or a movie, this is when Sherlock Holmes explains all the clues and how those clues led him to solve the mystery. In a video game or a board game, this is the accusation phase. The player decides that they have found enough information to figure out the mystery, and they declare that they are done looking for clues, done looking for more information, and they go and do their best to explain what happened in the mystery.
I love this process of information gathering that you're talking about. I want to dive a little deeper into what kinds of information you might encounter through this process. One of the things that is core to a capital M mystery is having suspects. And I think in order to identify a character in your game as a suspect, they need to have some combination of these three things: means, motive, and opportunity. If a character that you present to your players has a motive to commit the crime, they're quickly going to become a really important suspect. But there are other ways that they could become a suspect as well. If they had the opportunity to commit the crime, if it's a murder mystery and they were the only one in the room with the person that was murdered, even if you don't know their motive, they still are a top suspect because they were the only ones with the opportunity to commit the crime. And if your mystery involves a bank heist, then whoever has the means of breaking into a vault, maybe a powerful thief or a powerful lockpick or somebody that can teleport, then they had the means to commit your crime and they're going to be a top suspect as well. And you can increase your suspicion of all of these different suspects in your game by combining the means and the motive and the opportunity. And when your players figure out that a suspect had all three, they're probably the one who committed the crime.
And your characters that only have two of these three things, or one of these three things, become really compelling red herrings. When we think about red herrings, this phrase often has a bad connotation to it, because it is the author, or in this case, the dungeon master, that is kind of tricking their players. But that doesn't need to be the case. Audience members really like red herrings when they decided to zoom in on specific information that was leading them to coming to the conclusion that this person had to be the culprit because fill in the blank, and they ignore the other counter information that you give them that proves their innocence. Imagine the bumbling blacksmith who no one in town likes. He's a horrible person. He has outwardly and publicly said that he was going to kill the victim out in the public square. He has tons of weapons in his shop. He had the motive and he had the means. But on the night of the murder, he was seen by many, many reputable witnesses drinking in the tavern. Your players are going to be drawn to this information that almost makes it too obvious that he was the murderer. And then once they find out that he did not have the opportunity, he had the means and the motive, it clears this red herring. And finding that information is an aha moment to the players instead of a you tricked us moment.
And maybe a really great way to help your players figure out that this in fact is a red herring is, like you said, to have many reputable people have seen the blacksmith drinking that night. I think it's really important for a good Dungeons & Dragons adventure, especially, for there to be more than enough information. You can have lots of different places, lots of different ways for your players to figure out the clues that they need. Because it's not a book where you get to put the protagonist wherever you want with the stroke of a pencil. Your players are involved in the storytelling as well. So having multiple people that can confirm the blacksmith's location and their alibi is really important. In the same way that having many different clues for your players to find the actual perpetrator, I think, is extremely important. That way, you don't railroad them into the one clue that you've set for them. If there are many different clues that they can find, they get to explore the world and be protagonists in their own story and have a more sandbox experience where they're making deductions and they're finding evidence and they're sorting through the evidence on their own. And I think that that's a really important part of a D&D specific adventure.
And this brings us to perhaps the hardest thing about running a mystery in the rule set of Dungeons & Dragons, which is, how do you present the clues to your players? During the research for this episode, we looked at a lot of different detective board games and video games to figure out how you can deliver the fantasy of being a detective to a player. And in all of these cases, these games use different mediums to present players with too much information. Some games use pictures or three-dimensional crime scenes where the players are free to kind of like look around and navigate these crime scenes at their own free will. Some of these games, like Sherlock Consulting Detective, have books and books of information that you can go and interact with, things like newspapers, where most of the articles have almost nothing to do with the crime that you're trying to solve. But by reading through the entire newspaper, you can pick out maybe a few leads here and there that might be relevant clues to the case that you're solving, or might not be if you got confused about a date or maybe confused two names together or two addresses together. This is really hard in Dungeons & Dragons because typically the information that is presented by the Dungeon Master is relevant because we are trying to control the pacing of our game. As a Dungeon Master, you almost never want to present your players with irrelevant information because it sends them careening down a rabbit hole that is the opposite direction of where the adventure is. And when you're trying to present the mystery genre to your players, you're really trying to do the exact opposite. So if your players aren't prepared to be presented with a lot of superfluous information, this can actually be a little bit derailing for your game, or at the very least, a confusing experience.
Yeah, how many times as a DM do you say something offhand and your players start talking about it for the next 45 minutes and you weren't planning for this conversation to happen at all? And I think that this experience in a mystery game could happen 1,000 times, and then it would take a whole week to finish a campaign like this.
Exactly. So this process, this core process of presenting your audience with superfluous information, too many clues, is pretty different from the typical Dungeons & Dragons experience. And doing this can be very difficult, especially if you haven't prepared your players and said, hey, this is a mystery. Some of the information that I present to you will not be relevant. It is up to you to decide which information that I am presenting to you is important, is a clue, is relevant to the solving of this case.
I don't even think you necessarily need to do this before the session starts. I think you can set the tone for a capital M mystery in lots of very clear and exciting ways. You can use buzzwords with your NPCs, asking if they can sleuth out the answer to this problem, if they can deduce where somebody might have been, if they think that there's motive for a certain suspect. If you start really getting involved in the genre as a concept, then your players, I think, are going to pick up on the idea. Maybe if you know your players well, that's enough to get them in the mindset of a mystery where they have to parse through red herrings and this kind of misinformation.
And then another thing, Ariel, that I don't want to gloss over because it's really important, is this idea that you have many, many clues that allow your players to make the same deduction. So if the mystery is a story that maybe has 10 things that happened in it, and you need for your players to figure out those 10 things that happened, those 10 plot points or those 10 relevant pieces of information to solve the mystery, it's very important that you have many clues all relating to the same piece of information that they need to figure out. Maybe 3 clues per piece of information. And now all of a sudden you're really starting to understand how much preparation and work goes into making a capital M mystery. Because if you need 3 pieces of information or 3 clues that allow your players to make 1 of 10 deductions, already we're talking a minimum of 30 clues that are relevant. And now you need to bolster that information with maybe like 15 to 25 pieces of information that are irrelevant or red herrings. We're already near like 50 different clues that you need to prepare as a Dungeon Master in order to present a capital M mystery to your players in a way that feels authentic. This can sound really daunting, but luckily there are tools or ways that we can organize this information when we're planning out our capital M mystery that can make this a lot easier. So when we're thinking about the actual mystery, the thing that happened, the story that happened that we want our players to uncover as they investigate this mystery, maybe the pieces of information that we feel are important are who did it, why did they do it, and how did they do it? That's a pretty simple mystery, right? Like most mysteries are a little bit more convoluted. There are more people. Maybe the things that had been happening over a period of time. And as a result, there's way more different clues and consequences that we need to think about. And I think those types of mysteries are really interesting. When we think about the mystery that is present in Curse of Strahd, the story of Strahd's life is the mystery. And clues to this mystery that fill in little pieces of that story are present all over the entire region of Barovia. That's pretty in-depth. And the module is basically the book of how to run the Mystery of Strahd, the D&D adventure. But if we're trying to run a smaller, contained mystery, maybe it's just these three things. Who did it? Why did they do it? How did they do it? We want there to be multiple clues that point to those pieces of information, just in case the players miss a clue, or perhaps we do a not so great job of presenting that clue to the player in a way that is, maybe it's confusing and it's our fault that they don't put the two pieces together. Thank goodness we have another chance at presenting this information to the players without saying, oh, you misinterpreted that clue that I gave you. It actually means this. So we put these three things that they need to figure out on a spreadsheet, and we put three items next to each of those three things. Now we need 9 clues. That's not so bad. But we also need some superfluous information. So maybe we include 9 pieces of information that are details about the setting, the people, the relationships that aren't directly related to the mystery that's being solved, to give our players the opportunity to decide that this information is not relevant, because that is a part of the fantasy of solving a capital M mystery. Now, all of a sudden, this preparation, which is kind of expansive, I mean, 20 clues isn't nothing, starts to feel a lot more manageable and a lot more approachable.
I love that you brought up Strahd as an example of a capital M mystery, because I think it's a great point about how a mystery can work in a D&D setting. Some of these clues are hidden behind intense combats, and this is something I don't think you would see in a Sherlock Holmes setting mystery. But it is something you might see in a Batman setting mystery. Because in a Batman setting, you know that fighting and combat are on the table.
So we've talked about suspects and what makes a compelling suspect. And we also talked about clues and how you can make sure that you have enough clues or the right clues to make sure, especially in a cooperative storytelling experience, that the players encounter enough information to figure it out. The last piece that is core to a game that tries to deliver the detective fantasy, the capital M mystery fantasy, is the accusation. The point in the game where the players feel like they've discovered enough information to declare, I figured it out. This is what happened. And they have the chance to be right or wrong. But there is a benefit to declaring that you're ready earlier rather than later.
I think this is a great piece of the whole mystery puzzle that is underlying an important concept, that your players should have enough control that they can say when they're ready for the mystery to end. I think this is exceptionally important in a game of Dungeons & Dragons, that you give your players enough space and enough time to go through all the leads they want to go through and to interrogate all the suspects they want to interrogate, and or at least give them enough time to look through all the clues that they are ready to make an accusation.
In a lot of games, the accusation phase, where the players opting into the time where they want to make their accusation, is a safety net for the game. It means that the players won't run into a situation, probably, where they don't solve the mystery. This is our biggest fear in Dungeons & Dragons. We put this mystery in front of our players, and they can't solve it, and they're just dead stuck. And then as the DM, you need to just give them the answer to the mystery. That is the failure, the risk of running a capital M mystery, or even a lowercase m mystery in Dungeons & Dragons. That is your main plot that you are following. These board games and these video games kind of sidestep this issue by, first of all, giving players more than enough information to solve the mystery, and almost really like an endless supply of clues, but then also including a reason or an incentive why the players can't go and get all those clues and should jump to the accusation phase as soon as they think that they've got it figured out, potentially foregoing some leads and some other clues that they think might be in other places around the city or town, because there's a ticking clock of some sort, or they might get a higher score the less clues that they needed to figure out the mystery.
So I think an example of how you might do this in D&D is somewhat similar to other ways that we've incorporated pacing and villains with plans into Dungeons & Dragons. If you know the next day that there is an airship scheduled to leave, and your prime suspect has a ticket to leave on this airship, then you have something pressuring you in order to solve the crime and make the accusation before the next day. I think it's still important to make sure your players have a lot of space to solve the crime, follow the leads, and make their accusation. And maybe if they need to, they can even get in the way of this perpetrator getting on the airship, or cause a distraction or delay the airship while they're still solving the mystery. But you want to have some reason, some piece of pressure in the back of their mind that makes them think that they have a deadline for solving the mystery, or makes them think that solving the mystery sooner is going to be better for them.
I think that another way of achieving this is to give the mystery or the campaign hit points. Perhaps the mystery is that once a day, every day, at 12 o'clock p.m., another villager in the town drops dead of some unknown necrotic reason.
Ooh, yeah, this is a great thing. This is a great incentive.
Now, every extra day that the players take to solve the mystery, another villager in the town dies. They've been meeting these different villagers, so now all of a sudden the players are starting to form relationships with them. And perhaps you as the DM are just rolling randomly behind your screen to figure out which villager on your list of villagers dies. This is a great way to make the mystery personal to the players as well. Perhaps they meet one villager who seems like they're just a really nice person, and they're very helpful to the adventurers, and maybe you're role-playing them in a very kind of funny and fun way as the DM. And then on one of these nights, they're one of the villagers that passes away. Now all of a sudden your players are feeling the pace of this adventure. They need to solve this before another villager passes away.
You know, it's actually a great example of this. Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. You have a situation where as the days go by and as the capital M mystery is, you know, still ongoing and not yet solved, more people get turned to stone. And eventually, since the mystery drags on too long, one of your favorite characters is now in danger and is turned to stone.
I think that's a great example. Sometimes I come up with ideas that I think are original, and then it turns out, nope, in the back of my head, there was some reference that I was thinking of instead.
No, I think you just have the literary spirit in you, Ray, and you're in tune with these great tropes and great ideas.
Well, once you've seen the same trope enough times, they start to blend together and become something different altogether.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to like musicians. They always kind of have to ask each other eventually, like, did I come up with this melody or did I hear it at some concert 10 years ago?
Exactly.
So I think once you've kind of got all these pieces together, your suspects, your clues, your accusation, you still have a little bit of a ways to go before introducing D&D to your game. And I think the context of your story is very important to consider. Imagine there are so many different mystery stories and mystery settings. We don't necessarily think about them so differently, but a mystery that you'd present in a Nancy Drew book is so different from a mystery that you'd present in maybe an episode of Batman the Animated Series. And there's good reasons why we should consider this before we start putting a mystery into Dungeons & Dragons.
Exactly. I would argue that any of the people out there that are saying that Dungeons & Dragons is not a compatible rule set with mysteries, there's just too many things in Dungeons & Dragons that invalidate the mystery. I would argue that those people are not setting appropriate mysteries in their games of Dungeons & Dragons.
Thinking about combat in different mystery settings is a very easy way to see this. We would have almost no combat in Nancy Drew, maybe some combat, you know, one-on-one combat in a Sherlock Holmes story. And in a Batman story, you could even have the villain holed up in a hideout with all of their thugs at the very end of the mystery. And in order to get the perpetrator, Batman has to go in and clear out the hideout, fighting dozens of thugs, and then finally resolve the mystery with an insane combat between him and the villain. That's not something you would want to put in a Sherlock Holmes mystery. Similarly, we want combat to exist in a D&D mystery in a way that is fulfilling to the genre.
So the first thing that you'll want to do to make sure you're telling a setting-appropriate D&D mystery is that you'll want to come up with some reasons why the normal people the typical villagers or town's guards, or even maybe the priest or the low-level wizard of that city, cannot solve the case. In all of these stories where we have iconic detectives that are better detectives than all of the detectives around them, they solve the cases that no one else can and are called upon to solve those cases.
So we want an obvious reason why someone from the town is reaching out to a group of adventurers and giving them the promise of gold with this quest to solve the mystery. I think the setting of D&D lends itself so well to a magical perfect crime, one that you would need an amazing amount of expertise in order to solve. Think about the spells like Dimension Door and Disguise Self and Knock and Unseen Servant. These are all magical ways that somebody could get through intense defenses and leave very little trace. You would really want to have somebody expert in the arcane with detect magic skills and the ability to cast Dimension Door themselves, perhaps, so that they could solve a mystery like this. And that's not something that regular townsfolk are going to be able to do. It's also something that your players at the table are going to feel make a lot of sense for the D&D setting. It's going to feel very natural, and it's going to feel a lot like other spells that they've used in their own campaigns. And suddenly, when a mystery that they're solving involves a spell like Dimension Door, they're going to understand that this capital M mystery is not something they'd find in a Sherlock Holmes story or in a Batman story. It needed to be told in their D&D campaign.
Exactly. Have the mystery include things that maybe only your players have experience with or the expertise to solve. When we see Commissioner Gordon call upon the Batman and fire up the bat signal, it isn't to go after a bank robber who just held up a bank and they know where he is. They just got to go get him, right? It's to deal with a supervillain or a cold case that the Gotham police are just completely inequipped to deal with. When we look at Sherlock, Sherlock doesn't work for the police. He's called upon by Inspector Lestrade, usually almost begrudgingly. Lestrade hates to call upon Sherlock, but he cares more about solving the crime and more people not getting hurt than he does about his own personal pride. And he comes to Sherlock begrudgingly and says, "We have a case for you. Here you go. Good luck. I doubt even you could figure this out." And then the game is afoot, right? Like, this isn't the day job of these people, these iconic detectives. They are in this game business of solving mysteries because it is the thing that brings them joy in life. That's what makes an iconic detective.
I love this similarity between the bat signal or Lestrade coming to Sherlock as an analog for quest giving in D&D. It's a call to action. It's a search for heroes who can save the day. And I think that this similarity is something that we should latch onto and really try to make a part of our D&D campaign. Your players are going to recognize these tropes, this idea that they're the only ones who can solve this mystery. And I think it's going to make it all that more fun, and it's going to get them in the mindset that they're in this capital M mystery.
But the Dungeons & Dragons setting does come with some specific challenges. We talked about in the very beginning of the episode how there are some spells in Dungeons & Dragons that will invalidate a mystery that was not designed with those spells in mind.
I think a great example is Speak with Dead. And if you're introducing a mystery into your D&D adventure, I think it's important just to have a little bit of thought about what this spell means for your mystery. If you're very nervous about it, maybe you put in a mystery where the body is lost. They can't find the body. And maybe some of the clues eventually lead to the body, so that when your players are smart and they find the body and then you speak with dead, based on finding clues and leads, they feel rewarded. And this speak with dead cheat spell actually feels earned. I think leaning into these spells and allowing your players to use them in a smart way can make your players feel like these magical detectives who were the only ones that could have solved the crime. So I actually am okay with using Speak with Dead as long as you're careful about how you put it into the game. Another example might be using the Disguise Self spell, where the body that you speak to actually has the wrong information. The body believes somebody else killed them because they were under disguise. So this is, I think, one way of spending a little bit of time thinking about these spells in order that you don't invalidate your own mystery. But if you come up with a really good solution, suddenly you've taken a weakness in the D&D mystery setting and turned it into a strength. And I think that's really cool.
The same is true of spells like Locate Object or Scry. If you take a look at those spell descriptions, you can figure out what the limitations of those spells are and what the ranges of those spells are. Depending on the sophistication of the villain or the tier of your adventure, your villain may take specific steps to prevent those spells from working. And that in and of itself is a very powerful clue to the adventurers. If I can't scry on an object, it probably means that it's inside a lead box. The only reason why the villain or the culprit would put the item that I'm trying to scry on inside of a lead box is if they themselves know the details of how scrying works. No wizard is going to tell just random people how the scry spell works to make their own magic less effective. Now perhaps we know for sure that we're dealing with another wizard as the culprit.
I think it's really important here to understand that these limitations that you're planning around can be turned into strengths. Knowing that the scry spell is blocked by a lead box is a clue or a lead in and of itself. You can then go over to the blacksmith shop and ask if anybody purchased a lead box recently. I think similarly, if I were playing an adventure where I wanted to lean into the locate object spell as a possibility for my players, I might have the villain put the object in a bag of holding, and I would have the locate object spell return very weird feelings, feelings that seemed alien or interdimensional, and that would give my players a hint or a clue that they could go to a magic shop or they could ask around into who has access to this magical artifact, because not everyone is going to have a bag of holding. Maybe the town wizard, who was the quest giver in the first place, is actually the perpetrator.
Oftentimes, we'll mention how putting constraints on a creative process can actually lead you to create a better or a more complete story with answers to these constraints that you're placing around your creative process. I think that the common spells that people run into that ruin their Dungeons & Dragons mysteries are actually just challenges. They're gauntlets to say, hey, other DMs out there, when you design your mystery, I'm interested to find out how you stop this spell from ruining your mystery.
Yeah, and I do think it's important to me to not have a scenario where the villain outsmarted every single one of your player's spells every time you run a mystery. I think sometimes that's fun, but sometimes that's not a good experience. You want your players' spells to make them magical, powerful detectives. So finding a balance of which spells your players can use, which spells your villains have a plan for, and which spells just don't make sense for your mystery. You know, if the body is gone in this mystery and is never found, then Speak with Dead isn't relevant for this mystery, and that's okay. But just balancing which ways your players are going to be able to interact with the world, I think is really multifaceted. And you can let them do these really powerful spells and make them feel like magical mystery solvers, as long as you do it in the right ways.
I thought that your example, Ariel, of going to ask the blacksmith if anybody purchased a lead box recently was genius. If I was designing this mystery, I don't know if I as the DM would have thought about where did they get the lead box. And now all of a sudden when my player says, oh, my scry didn't work, it must be inside of a lead box, let's go ask the blacksmith about whether or not someone bought a lead box. You better bet for sure that I'm going to put a lead there. If the blacksmith doesn't point them immediately to the culprit, just because I'm so impressed with the player who figured that out, he's certainly going to point them in the direction of the person that did buy the lead box, but then that box was perhaps stolen from that person, or that person was forced to give it up to someone.
Purchased through an intermediary.
It will send them towards another important lead or clue to reward them for thinking in an ingenious manner.
So all of these spells are interesting challenges, but I actually think that they are not the hardest challenge to a Dungeons & Dragons specific mystery in the slightest. I think that the nature of skill checks in D&D poses a much bigger challenge to running a mystery than any of these mystery-breaking spells.
In all the research I was doing, looking at mystery board games and mystery video games, there wasn't a single example of a game that might not give you access to clues depending on your roll of the dice or some element of chance. All of these games always make all of the clues available to the player, if only they follow the right leads or go to the right places.
I'm reminded of some experiences I've had as a DM, where players look at their character sheets, they know that these skill checks are available to them, and so they lean on them a little bit. And when we go into a new room, instead of looking around first themselves and asking me questions, they go into the room and the first thing they say is, I want to make a perception check. What do I see in the room? And they want to roll their die and they want to maybe get a high number and get some information about the setting. I think this is somewhat antithetical to the experience of a capital M mystery. If you go into a room and you roll a die and you roll high and get the clue, you didn't have to do deduction, you didn't work for it. And even worse, if you go into a room and you roll low, suddenly these clues are now unavailable to you, and maybe the mystery is stopped in its tracks until your players pick up on a different lead.
In all the examples that I was seeing on the internet of other folks explaining how to run a mystery in Dungeons & Dragons, This was an aspect that I felt they kind of glossed over. They talk about all the clues that you could have and what DC skill checks they were hiding those clues behind. And that to me struck me as very anti-capital M mystery genre. When you block clues that could be used to solve the puzzle, when you block puzzle pieces behind skill checks, you're doing something that feels counterproductive to the promise that you are presenting to the players when you say, hey, we're going to solve a mystery.
Yeah, I think that's the perfect word choice. You want to fulfill a promise to your players that they are going to sleuth around and make deductions, and they're going to feel like they solved the mystery based on their own merits and their own problem solving. That, at least to me, is the most important feeling I want my players to have. I don't want my players to have a feeling where they are good at skills, and so they rolled high and won the mystery. I don't want it to feel like winning so much as I want it to feel like a process of problem solving.
I just want to cut in real quick because you said something so perfect, Ariel. The verb there, solve. You don't want to win the mystery, which you win games by rolling high enough. You don't solve games by rolling high enough. We want to solve the mystery. And to solve the mystery, it means that you, the player, or the audience, needs to put the pieces together yourself.
Yeah, that's perfect. And I think that the important thing is that your players would describe themselves as solving the mystery. You want your players to describe their own experience as deducing and solving. That's what I want them talking about after the mystery is over. After we leave the table and go home, I want them telling their friends about this mystery that they solved, not this game that they won. So for me, I think my background in the game Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective involves a lot of really detailed descriptions. If my players go into a room for the first time and they ask me, well, what's in the room? I want to give them a description that's detailed enough that they can pick up on the things that they want to investigate. If when my players go into the room, I describe what's on each of the walls and all the things that are in the room, I'm prompting them to investigate specific features in the room that I described. And I think that this is a great way to get around the problem of perception checks. If my players know what's in the room already, and they feel like the room is a place where they are ready to explore, then they're going to go in and they're going to ask me about specific things that I described. They're not just going to ask for one die roll that's going to give them all the clues.
Another way that I've seen some games do this really well is through handouts or visuals. They say a picture tells 1,000 words. Well, it's really useful then for about 60% of those words in the picture to be clues, and for about 40% of those words in the picture to be superfluous information. This is why we see detective video games being very effective at this, because it's the entire thing is a visual experience. It is for the player to point and click at the things that they feel are important or relevant to solving the mystery. In Dungeons & Dragons, or in some board games, we can solve this problem with handouts. We can create these pictures or these articles that have lots of information in them, too much information in them for players to know exactly what's important, but someone who knows what to look for might be able to pick out some really important details that could lead them to the next location or the next clue.
So Ray and I have both talked about how planning a mystery does take a significant amount of preparation as a DM. It's something you want to do with care and something you want to be deliberate about. But I think this process of creating really detailed descriptions of every room and having handouts is maybe too much work for a lot of DMs. It really takes a lot of time and care to build out all these things and run your game. And then on top of that, to make visualizations for each of those things is very hard. So I don't think that this is the only solution. For me, when the players come to a skill check and I don't have a handout prepared, I'll sometimes pause and ask them to elaborate on their skill check. If they go into the room and ask to see what's in the room, I might say, well, where would you want to focus? What are you interested in finding? And then maybe they'll hone in and they'll say, oh, I want to check behind the paintings to see if there's a hidden vault. And suddenly my players are doing something actionable, they're engaging with the room and they're moving things around, and they're not doing the skill check. Or after they tell me what they want to do, I can have them roll the die and give them some more information, but it feels like they've earned the clue if they find it because they were specific about what they were looking for. So for me, this has worked really well if I don't have all the time in the world to prepare handouts and detailed descriptions of every room.
I think this idea of making a list of clues that you know exist in the room and waiting for your players to be protagonists, to go and act in that setting, to go and find those clues, is a really good idea. One very serious risk that I see, though, in Ariel's example, which I believe is one that has worked really well in the mysteries that Ariel himself has run, is that if your players do not engage with that part of the room that had that secret clue, whether it's the desk that has a button underneath it that reveals a secret compartment, or it's the portrait that has a vault behind it, then your players could miss out on that clue. And you are relying on your players' recollection of other mystery stories that they've experienced in order to trigger those actions. And as a dungeon master, you have to be really careful about ways that you kind of nudge your players in the direction of those clues, because you really don't want to give the players the feeling like they didn't find the clues. What's the point of asking the players what they would like to interact with in the room if you are just going to give them all of the clues to begin with? However, it is really important that the players do wind up finding most, if not all, of the important clues in a location. So what do we do?
For me, I like to put in so many clues into my game that if my players only find a portion of them, they still have enough information to solve the mystery. So sometimes if a player is going to a room and they don't find the clue, that's okay with me. But I do think that can be a really frustrating experience for the players sometimes, where if their process of solving the mystery is just asking me questions until they have asked the right question and found the clue, then all they're doing is playing 20 questions and not actually doing deductive sleuthing. And so I think that that is, you know, definitely an issue with this kind of approach. But if your players are relying on skill checks too much, it's something that you can do to maybe help introduce them to the experience of searching and exploring the room rather than asking for skill checks. If I pause and ask them, what do you want to explore? What are you interested in looking for? Maybe the next time they go into a room, instead of asking me a bunch of questions, they start actually interacting with things and moving into the room as their first instinct.
I think you bring up a really important point there, Ariel, that part of this process is kind of setting expectations for your players, right? Our players have a lot of experience playing traditional Dungeons & Dragons. When we start a combat, we don't need to kind of tell our players how the combat is going to work. They feel very comfortable running their character in initiative, taking actions and attacking monsters because they know how it works. For some of our players, playing a mystery game like this is going to be a new experience. So I think that kind of helping to initiate the types of things that someone might do while they're sleuthing a mystery is helpful and will help your mystery be a success to your players.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because sometimes I feel like I need to teach my players how to do combats as well. Like, I need to teach them how to not just run in and attack the first enemy that they see, or I need to teach them that it's okay to retreat and run away from some combats. And that experience of taking new players and giving them consequences for doing certain things in combats is also something I've done. So I think this kind of experience of using your game to kind of give your players lessons and how to interact with the world is something that I've done in other contexts as well. So it felt very natural to me to do that in a mystery setting.
Absolutely. One pitfall that I see with this process of asking about clues. So we started off talking about how most mystery board games give players all of the information, and then the players sift through that information to figure out what's important. But that requires probably too much work on the part of the Dungeon Master. So now we're talking about ways that you can deliver those clues without needing to do that upfront work. And we're running into a situation where, because the players can't see everything, you are their only lens into this world. They're asking you all different types of weird and wacky questions, and you could run into a situation where the players actually aren't sure when they found all the clues, right? So maybe the players find the clue that was behind the portrait, and it's been 30 minutes now, and they're ripping up floorboards, and they're punching out ceiling tiles, and they're breaking all the furniture, and they're interrogating the butler who doesn't know anything, and they're cutting off his fingers one by one until they found them.
This has literally happened to me. Like, this is actually a thing that happens, where, like, my players are like, no, there must be more clues, and I'm like, how do I tell them that they can go on to the next lead?
and that's a serious problem also. So I don't know if this is the perfect answer to this, but it is probably the solution that I will use to this, where when the players enter a room, there will be different tiers of clues. There are clues that I will present in the opening description of the room. If there's a body on the ground, that's going to be in the opening description. There are going to be some clues that they just can't miss. Then there's going to be another tier of hidden clues. And these are the clues that the mundane people, the town guard, the detective, the priest, these are the clues that those people missed. How are my players going to find those clues? And to me, when I'm thinking about the mystery genre, the answer is generically by being iconic. Like, what is iconic about the player characters that make them different from everyone else? And I will ask the player characters to investigate the room in a way that only their character can. That's the prompt. And then the players will come up with some cool skill that they have and some interesting way of casing the room that no one else would be able to do. And I really want to avoid dice rolls in this case. I would love for them to just give a detailed description of what they're doing and let that be. Then I'll have a list of hidden clues. And these could be like secret papers or secret banknotes or perhaps a sensitive material that can only be found in like one plant or one factory in the village or town or city. And I won't have decided where these clues are in the room yet. What I'm waiting for is the player to be iconic, and I will then place the clue behind the thing that is them being iconic. So maybe the wizard starts off this iconic check by saying, well, I'm going to cast detect magic. Awesome. That's something that only the wizard can do. Oh, it turns out that there's a brick over on the other side of the wall or a section of the wall that is an illusion. And the wizard said, well, I'm going to cast dispel magic on that illusion. And it's a vault. And now the thief in the party says, well, I'm going to go and pick that lock. Right? They're being iconic. They're doing only the things that they can do inside this room. And that is what is going to reveal to them this second tier of evidence. And each of the players know that they only get one chance to be iconic in this room. It's a part of the game of all of this. And once they've completed their iconic checks, and they've investigated everything that was in the original description of the room, they know that it's possible that they missed a clue or two, but that they have to leave. If there's something else in the room that they missed, the rules of the game are such that they just missed that clue. And they know that there'll be plenty of backup clues that will allow them to solve the mystery without that clue. It might just take them an extra location that they have to visit or an extra person that they have to speak with.
I think this idea of an iconic check is kind of combining two things for me, at least, in Dungeons & Dragons. I think this is kind of combining 4th edition skill challenges, which is something that I think has increased in popularity in 5th edition recently and is a lot of fun, with the principle of not making your players roll for things that they are very good at. For instance, if there is a large lava pit that somebody wants to jump over, if their character has the ability to jump over this pit, I don't need to make them roll for it, potentially roll a 1 and fall into the pit. So I think this is similar too. You're taking a look at the scenario. You're asking all of your players, okay, what are you great at? What is something that you are going to succeed at? And tell me how you would interact with the room using that skill. And now you can present these clues that are available to your players through their best skills. And I think that's a great way of making your players feel like they are iconic detectives in the story and that they have the perfect set of skills to solve this mystery. There was a reason they were called to action, and it's exactly because of these proficiencies. So I think this is a really cool idea. It's certainly something that I would choose to use with a group of people that I know would enjoy the feeling of being amazing detectives without having to necessarily look for every single clue in every single room.
Unfortunately, that's almost all of the time we have left. It feels like we've been talking for forever. It feels like we've been talking for more than 24 hours. This episode was actually perhaps so long that we had to stop in between because we needed to go to work yesterday. So if you could hear in the episode where our voices change, because that's where that point is, good for you. And if you missed it, you have to go back and listen to the whole thing all over again. But we covered a lot in this episode. We talked about the differences between a mystery that is in the background of your story, but the solving of that mystery is not core to the completion of your story. And we compared that to what a capital M mystery is. Capital M mystery being a genre-defining mystery. A mystery that has clues, superfluous information, suspects that are of a very specific type. And we also talked about something that appears in mystery board games and video games, which is the accusation. The moment where the players feel like they have accumulated enough clues and enough evidence where they don't want to risk going and finding more because they think they know who the culprit is, and they go and make the accusation, ending the mystery.
We talked about how when you're designing a mystery for Dungeons & Dragons, you can lean into the setting that you're in to make it feel like a very D&D-specific adventure, that the same mystery that's going to work in a Sherlock Holmes or Nancy Drew story is not going to work necessarily for a Dungeons & Dragons story. And we talked about different themes and different spells you can use to really lean into this feeling of a D&D-specific mystery.
And lastly, we talked about skill checks and how they're pretty problematic for Dungeons & Dragons mysteries. We basically kind of talked about all the different ways that you cannot use skill checks while you are running a Dungeons & Dragons mystery, or disguise them in such a way where they don't potentially break your mystery or make your players feel like they would have found that clue if only they had been in the room and their stupid die hadn't rolled low.
Exactly. With all these different mechanics in D&D and spells and skill checks, it's about finding the right balance and making them work for your mystery campaign. But in the next episode, we'll focus on putting all of these things together. Everything we've talked about, I think, can be a bit of a daunting experience to design into an actual session of D&D, but we have specific tools that we've found work really well for putting these things together in a systematic way so that you don't have to be a genius to put together an exciting mystery. Until next time, I'm Ariel Rasko.
And I'm Raymond O'Connor.
And thanks for listening to Running Off the Rails.
If you enjoyed Running Off the Rails, please like, follow, and review our show on your platform of choice. Please follow our Instagram, Running Off the Rails, for notifications whenever we release a blog post, a new episode, or new content on the DMs Guild. If you prefer a specific type of content, please send us a message on Instagram. The jam you are listening to is Hoist by Andy G. Cohen, and you can find Hoist and more of Cohen's music on the Free Music Archive. You can find links to all of our content at runningofftherails.com or on our Facebook page, Running Off the Rails.